Hello, my name's Kate Rowles and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's artwork One Another. The date today is the 19th of September 2009 and the time is 8:15 a.m. If I can please ask you to say your full name, your age and where you come from.
My name is Ralph Spurrier, I'm 61 and I come from Hassocks in Sussex, which is just about 10 miles from Brighton.
And how are you today?
A little bit anxious, but I'm a bit better now than I'm actually sitting here.
What's making you anxious, do you think?
Just the thought of being on show to all and sundry. I know it's not very busy at the moment, but the fact that I'm being watched by whoever online is a little bit anxious making, because I am not a showman. I'm quite retired, really.
Why did you decide to apply to be part of One Another?
It's a little bit difficult to say now because I'm thinking, why did I do this? But it was a chance to say something about the work that I've been doing in the last year, and it's a point in life where I'm moving onwards from something I've been doing for 40 years into something else, and I put my name in the hat, not expecting it to come out, and it did. So it's actually moved me on personally quite a bit. Just this coming here and having to do this has moved me on.
In what way do you think?
Because I've been a bookseller for 40 years, and I wanted to be a writer, and I should have been a writer 30 years ago. And I've been playing about with it, but I've recently done a master's degree in creative writing at Sussex University. And that's really what I want to do next. And this seemed like a catalyst, as it were, to get me finished. I've almost finished the book, but this actually has made me get on and do it.
We'll come on to that in a moment.
Okay.
When you found out that you had got a place on the plinth, how did you then decide how you were going to spend your hour?
It took me quite a long time. I mean, I was quite excited by the thought of going on the plinth, and then I sat back and thought, well, what on earth am I going to do? And over the last 2 months or so since I was notified, I've been chopping and changing. But gradually over the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been obviously more focused, and I now have a very specific way I want to spend the hour.
And how did you decide to spend your hour?
It had to be connected with the work, the writing work that I was doing. And as I was saying to your one of the others outside, the fact that I'm actually on the plinth has changed the nature of the writing that I'm doing. So in an odd and weird way, this facility, this adventure has had a material impact on the writing that I'm doing.
How has it done so?
Because the novel that I'm writing, more or less, I had the whole plan set out, and it's a crime story, and like all crime stories, you have the punchline in the last page. And I thought as I neared my time on the plinth that I would write a spoof. It's difficult to explain, really. Better when I've done it. It's a spoof history of how I found the manuscript that I'm writing. So basically, I'm going up there and fooling people about the manuscript that I've discovered, which I'm going to edit and publish, but in fact I've already written it. So it's a double fooling of the public. So it's something that I've thought about in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and it works extremely well within the context of the crime novel that I'm writing.
And why did you decide to spend your hour in this way on the plinth?
Because I couldn't think of anything other. No, that's wrong. I couldn't think of anything other. It's because it seemed the only opportunity, a golden opportunity, to be able to expand my ideas and explain them to whoever wants to listen. And I've got quite a lot of friends online who are going to be watching. And it seemed just a perfect way of getting out there to a lot of people.
And so in a basic way, can I ask you to explain what you're going to do on the plinth today?
Okay, well, I'll be presenting a story, which is basically how I discovered this manuscript. It's a diary of a man who is condemned to death. He's got 3 weeks in prison before his execution, and he writes a diary. And I discover this diary in a library, which I buy from a house sale. And I explain who owned this diary, how it came into my possession, and all the research I've done into it. And I offer it as a spoof, as it were, but as a true crime story, but in fact it's a fiction. So the public are believing that this really happened, that I did find this manuscript, and in fact I've written it, and that's how I'm going to spend my time. Fooling the public, basically, the whole hour. And hopefully, I'll be reading a bit from the diary, which are quite emotional.
What inspired the work that you're writing?
Oh, I've been a bookseller. I've been specialising in crime fiction for 30 plus years, and I've been watching the development of crime fiction writing away from what they call the cosy world, the Agatha Christie kind of world, to something which is a little bit more reflective of the actual world as it is. And a lot of the work that I did in my master's degree was centred around the history of England just after the Second World War, because that's where it's set. So a lot of the work I've done, background history, is put into the story as verification of the world.
And have you, with your research that you've been doing, could you say a little bit about what you've learned?
Yes, it's been quite interesting, because I did my degree down at Sussex University. Unfortunately, they do have the mass observation archive down there, so I had easy access to all those fascinating pieces of paper that were handed in by people like myself, I suppose, back in the late 30s and 40s and early 50s. And so I did a lot of background reading on the cinema going, graffiti, pubs, and how people actually lived and worked and interacted with each other at that time. And that gave me a lot of, that fed into the story, and how actually after the Second World War, things weren't very easy at all. It was quite difficult. And that feeds into the emotional context of my characters, and how they interact with each other. So that was extremely useful. It's a very important part of the story.
And how did that make you feel about your work doing that research into the Mass Observation Archive?
Can you explain that a bit better?
Sure. Did it have you said that it was quite emotional for you.
Yes, it did have an impact, because it's quite easy. Not easy, but it's you can just sit and write a story, and the characters can remain two-dimensional. And I think it's very important for a writer to flesh out those characters, make them three-dimensional, make them work together, make them understand the world in which they live, and that the reader will then have a much more empathy with the characters, because they're actually living in a real world. With real emotions. And so when you read the archives of the Mass Observation, these are just plain, simple, straightforward, no-nonsense feedback from the ordinary Joe public, Joe and Jane public, to events that happen. And so you can filter those kind of things into the story. And that had a big effect on the whole structure of what I was writing. So that was very quite important.
And the character in your book is on death row.
Yeah, we don't call it death row in England. It was just, it's he was condemned to be executed. He had 3 weeks between the trial and the execution. So in those 3 weeks, he writes a diary because he's not guilty. He's not guilty of the crime in which he's being found. And because of it, the nature, his nature, he... and he likes crime stories, he teases. He writes the diary for the hangman, basically. He leaves it for the hangman, and he leaves clues inside the diary for the hangman. And he, when the hangman comes in at 9 o'clock, which is the time that all executions were carried out, and it's quite coincidental that I'm on the plinth at 9 o'clock. And so when he comes in at 9 o'clock to... take him through to the execution room, he says, "This is my diary, you must read this." And that's where the story starts. And so it's the character is, he's 23 in 1953, so he was born in 1930, his father dies in 1939, just before the Second World War, and his mother marries in 1947 a guy who comes back from the war, a soldier. And after that, everything goes downhill. And eventually, his mother gets murdered, and he's found guilty of the murder. But he didn't do it, someone else did, and he knows who did it. But there's incriminating evidence, and so he gets hung for it. But he leaves the story behind, and we are left to find out who actually did it. But we're not quite sure. Only the author knows who did it. But... It's a double bluff. It's almost a triple bluff to fool the reader all the way down the line, because they will think it's somebody else, but the last line it's actually another.
Do you think the writing that you do is about yourself in any way?
Oh yeah, I'm almost certain there's a lot of me in there, and it's got to be. It has to be. I think if you're a professional writer, which I'm not yet, you can stand aside and create these characters and perhaps invest them with emotions that are outside yourself. But at the moment, there's quite a bit of me in there somewhere. But I try and hide it.
And can I ask you about your decision to go and do an MA after your career as a bookseller?
Yeah.
What sparked that decision to take action in that way?
So when I was 18, 19, I didn't get enough A-levels to go on to university. And my father said, right, that's it. You're going out to work, which is 1966. So I joined Foyles up in the Charing Cross Road. Then I went to Macmillan, the publishers, then to Victor Gollancz, the publishers. Then I left there and started my own business. And then in 1997, I did a bachelor's degree in English, because I felt it would be quite nice to do that at Sussex. Then I left it 10 years and came back and do a master's degree. And I've always regretted not going to university when I was a young lad. But it's been great fun, and the people, the tutors that I've spoken to have always said that they quite like the mature students, because they're... perhaps they take more attention, and they do the work on time as well.
And what impact do you think that's had on you as a person going to university?
A lot, yes, a lot. It's made me, first of all, it's given me deadlines. I think everybody in life tends to let things drift. And when you get to this age of 61, you realise that the amount of time left to you is very limited. So, you know, I need to get on and do things, which I should have done 40 years ago. And going to university at this age has been a real boost, and it's woken me up a little bit. It's quite easy to just carry on in life and just tootle along doing whatever it is that pays the rent or pays the mortgage or whatever it is. But you need at some stage to stop and think, actually, this is once in a lifetime. You only have one lifetime, and I need to do something more interesting.
So what's important to you in your life at the moment?
Oh gosh, yes, we're on the cusp, you see. My two stepdaughters are just leaving for university now, today, after I've done this, I've got to go take one up to Birmingham University to drop her off. And when they've gone, that's it. We're on our own, as it were. So we're on that cusp of moving from family to just two of us. And that will take a little bit of time to get used to, but we've got plans, and we're off to America in 2 weeks' time to visit. And yeah, we're planning things to do together rather than a family. But I want to get this book published. Definitely want to get this book published, and keep on writing.
Can I ask you to say a little bit about your upbringing?
Oh right, upbringing. Gosh. Right, my father was, where do you want to, how far back do you want to go?
Shall we start with where you were born?
Okay, I was born in Birmingham, and occasionally I can put a lovely Birmingham accent on, but I left there when I was five. My father worked in the post office, or the Royal Mail, as it was then, and that was before the Second World War. He left to join the army, and he stayed in the Second World War for 6 years. I was born in 1947. My mother ran a post office, so they were very post office orientated people. But my father was, he wasn't used to children really. He found it quite difficult, and I found it quite difficult living with him. I understand now a lot more why he felt like he did, because going away to war for 6 years does things to people, as I discovered when I was writing this book. So they're both dead, unfortunately, now. So I actually quite miss him. I went to a primary school which was run by nuns, and then I passed 11 plus, and then I went to a secondary school run by priests. So I was inculcated into the Catholic religion quite heavily for some 11, 12 years, and then I dropped out when I was 17 because it was 1966, and everyone sort of dropped out really from organised religion, and I got to A level standard. I got English A level, and failed my Latin and failed my history, and so it was out to work. And then I got married when I was 23, just 23. That lasted 14 years. I had a second partner that lasted 14 years, and now I'm on my third partner, my wife, and we're now 8 years married. And hopefully this one will see me out, as it were. Yeah.
And you mentioned that you went to Catholic schools.
Yes.
And then you stopped being a Catholic.
Yes.
Are you still religious or not religious?
Not religious. No. No. If someone asked me what my faith was, it would be. It would be atheist, and it would probably be a radical atheist as well. If someone said to me, "Do you believe in God?" I say, "There is no God." So that's where I stand now. I still, there are elements of religion in the story. It's inevitable. They just creep in from around the corner, as it were, when you're not looking. But no, I'm not a religious person in those terms.
Can I ask you about your current wife?
Yes.
Would you like to mention her?
Yes, Lynn. Yes, Lynn is, she's 10 years, almost 11 years younger than myself. And after my second partner left, out of the blue, it was quite surprising really. I was 50 at that time, and I thought that was it really. It's not easy to form another relationship at that age, but quite by chance, she was widowed, and quite by chance we met up, and her two daughters were 10 and 8 at that time, and we seemed to click, and the last 8 years, 9 years, we've been bringing the children up, together, and they are now fully fledged human beings and off to university and doing quite well. So I'm quite proud of that. That they were quite low when I met them because their father recently died. But they've grown up to be beautiful girls, and one's doing fashion at Middlesex University, and the other one's doing chemical engineering at Birmingham, of which I have no idea what chemical engineering is about, but I'm sure it's very well paid at the end of the day.
And what are your passions in life now?
Oh, my passions are music. I was going to say first and last, but it's music and books, as the Plinth Hour will say. Books are very important to me, and I've always been. When I was about 9 or 10, I went to a jumble sale and bought half a set of Dickens, which I've still got. I've now completed the set, but that was the start of it. I've now got about 10,000 books, much to Lynn's dismay. But there's a core of about 1,000 I would never give away. I'd never give up. The other 9,000 could come and go, but music and books, and all kinds of music. I mean, classical music, jazz, and of course during the 60s it was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones and all that kind of stuff. So that still forms part of my history, as it were.
And
Is
Dickens one of your favourite authors?
No, not necessarily, no. I mean, he's a great writer. I mean, he's just, you know, the plots and the characters are just great. I haven't read them all by any means. Funny enough, for the Masters, we had to read Great Expectations, and that was the first Dickens I've read for many years. But it's great fun. But no, he's not my favourite by any means. No, James Joyce, as you will see on the plinth, has been a big. We actually, it's strange. We read it for A level in a Catholic school, and the character Stephen Dedalus runs away from the church in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, and we all read it and did exactly the same thing. So, but he's been a big moving force in my reading.
What did you like about James Joyce's writing?
It's difficult. It's difficult. When I first read Portrait of an Artist, it was difficult to read because it's not like Dickens. But what I really liked was the themes and symbols which he runs through all his book, the portrait, the symbols, and that's something I've used in my own story, is using a theme or a symbol to present an idea, that's been an influence.
And today, of course, you're going to be standing on the fourth pin. Who are you doing this for?
Ah, yeah, who am I doing this for? It's definitely for me. Oh yeah, I think so. I could say, oh, I'm doing it for whoever, but no, it is for me. It's a test of being able to get out on your hind legs and actually say something which is meaningful. Meaningful to me. The work that I've done is then, I'm passing it over to all the people there, and I want them to like it, obviously, you know. Any author wants people to like their writing, so this is quite a test. If they throw things at me or shout at me, then that might be a bit awful, but you've got to try it at some stage.
And any closing words?
Not really, no. But no, you've been very good at asking these questions, but this I see this as a pivotal point. I really do, and I've got to make it work. Yeah, there's no more chances in life. This is it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, cheers.